In today's show, I interview Mark Kahn, author, psychotherapist, BWRT practitioner, and corporate transformational coach. In this conversation, we explore self-esteem, neural therapy versus talk therapy, and understanding the physical manifestations of trauma. All of Mark's contact details can be found on the podcast page. Welcome, Mark. I'm so excited to have you on episode 4 of the Reinvent podcast.
Thank you.
Love yourself for no reason.
Yes.
Where did that come about?
Well, I had struggled personally with self-esteem since I was a kid. And obviously, so many of my clients struggle with self-esteem. And I started to look at where deficits in self-esteem come from. And my favorite story really is, you know, the little kid is, so little Nikki's 1 year old and she's walking for the first time and falls down and then stands up and walks, falls down. And she doesn't, after doing that 10 times, say, "Oh, I'm a failure. I'm useless. I'm giving up. You adults, you walk so well, you can even run." So, and I often say to my clients, so why do 1 year olds not do that? Say, "I'm a failure." And of course, most of them go, "I don't know." And then some of them will say, well, they haven't learned that yet. So bad self-esteem is a learned concept. Right. Little children, if they don't have a lot of trauma when they're very small, just feel great. They just go out there into the world and, "Hello, how are you?" And, "Oh, I'm wonderful." And, "Tell me, oh, I love your skirt," and whatever it is. So it's a programmed concept. And then what's really interesting is I often say to parents, so you love your little kid age 3, 4, 5, 6, and then they go to school and what happens? And one father actually recently said to me, "Yeah, you know, I've realized since my kid's gone to school, it's, I'll love you if you get good marks." Love is, I'll just love you and accept you as you are when you're very small. And then as you get to school and you have to perform and achieve, it's no longer for no reason. So we're just loved for being who we are. Well, and I call it a crime against humanity that we cannot love ourselves for no reason. We have to have a reason. And so there's original self-esteem, where there's just, I love myself. And then there's acquired self-esteem. I have good reasons to love myself. And it lasts 5 minutes. And I don't know if you know, my favorite example these days is Michael Phelps. So, you know, he's got 23 gold medals in Olympic swimming. And about 18 months ago, he gave a press conference where he came out to the world and said, "After every one of my 4 Olympics, I was so depressed I wanted to kill myself." Now, most of my clients are shocked. I am not remotely shocked. In fact, for me, it's predictable. Because what our society teaches, if you achieve, if you get gold medals and A's and you become a multiple PhD, whatever, and you make a fortune, you're fantastic. But it's acquired self-esteem. It's not inherent. There's not a sense of, I love myself just for who I am, whether I have the gold medal or not. And that's why Phelps was depressed. He repressed and bypassed all of his emotional pain and just swam for gold medals. So naturally, it will last a week. He would be high as a kite for a week. Manic, high, and then crash, depressed.
And this is common with most high achievers.
It's common with high achievers, and even low achievers are wishing they could be like that. So they're permanently depressed, thinking, if only I was beautiful and successful and rich and had gold medals, I would be okay.
So you get a new patient into your practice, and if you had to ask them, "Do you love yourself?" What is the response?
Well, I ask them, and I get I'll give you the range of answers I get. So I get stuff like no, or my kids love me, or sometimes, or a bit. So the answer is no, and sometimes. If I say, "Could you love yourself for no reason?" they say, "Well, that's arrogant."
A lot of us don't understand the difference between loving yourself, which doesn't mean arrogance. What is the difference between loving yourself and narcissism? Because the layperson doesn't understand there is a difference.
Well, you know, I coined a concept, I don't know if I ever told you about this, called the binary error. And I created the concept because every single one of my clients does it in some form or another, and it applies to this issue. So binary error is all or nothing, on or off, either or. So we either say we are useless and hopeless, or I think I'm fabulous, which is arrogance, which is binary. It's not seeing that there's a middle position. In my coaching work, I worked with a guy, a senior consultant guy, very introverted guy, who wanted to leave the company he was with. And he said to me, you know, I'm really bright and I'm good at what I do. And that was the middle position. And I often quote the way he said it. He didn't say, I'm bright and I know what I do. He wasn't arrogant and he wasn't self-effacing and inferior.
Stating a fact.
Yesterday, I said to another client, a woman, a very successful businesswoman, and I said, so you've been very good at creating a great, successful culture in your team. And she said to me, yes, I'm very good at it. And there was a sense of power and strength and value and great self-esteem. It wasn't arrogant, self-righteous, and it wasn't self-righteous. So what I'm helping clients to do is to get to the middle position, to see that option. Our culture doesn't give them that option. I mean, one of my clients, I remember when I'm working with the stuff, he says to me, yeah, my parents used to say if I got excited about a report or something, they'd say, be careful, your head will get so big it won't fit through the door. So that pushes him into the self-righteous inferior position and he has no self-esteem.
With children, you know, you can have the best intentions in the world. And for me, this is the scariest thing, is you've got this blank slate who copies you, doesn't do what you says, does what you do, and mirrors your deepest, darkest thoughts, even if you don't intend for that to happen. Yeah. How do we as parents start teaching children that in order to love other people, you've got to start with yourself, and it's not wrong. And you can have a spectrum of self-acceptance. It's not one or the other.
So I love your question, because the parents bring their kids to me and they want me to fix the kids. But the parents are anywhere between 20 and 90% of the problem. So you can to some degree teach your kids, but essentially your kids mimic you and model you. I remember there was a movie called The Bear, I think it was a silent movie, and I don't know if you ever saw it, in Alaska. Yeah.
Yes.
And you see the little bear's parents get killed in a rock fall. And then it's wandering around and it latches onto a big daddy bear and follows the daddy bear. And then the daddy bear shakes a pine tree. And there's this beautiful energy where you see the little bear goes to a little pine tree and is shaking the little pine tree. So that's what happens. So if the kid sees the mother behaving in an inferior way with her husband, letting the husband abuse her mentally, physically, emotionally, then the kid learns that. Parents, I mean, I had a woman recently come and see me and said she wanted parenting skills. And I said to her, well, you know, usually we need to work on your emotional stuff first so that what you present your child with as a mother is different. And she sees you behaving in a way where you are loving yourself. And we finished up. She had tons of trauma, you know, came out. So really, you know, how do you teach kids? If you have an opinion that 50% on a report card is frightening and bad and awful, your brainstem and your body are going to give that oh no response before you can decide to give the correct response, which would be, how do you feel about that, sweetie? Is it okay? And are you worried and judging yourself? And do you know why you got 50? Would you like to do better? So the right way to do it is to have a dialogue that is without prejudice or judgment. But you know, and that's where the neural therapy is so important. Yeah. The brainstem just pops up this, oh my God. And then it's too late. And you know, the Benjamin Libet research, it happens about a third of a second before the neocortex, the conscious mind, is aware of it. We can't control that stuff.
So let's chat about traditional talk therapy versus neural therapy, because many people listening will have gone for talk therapy. And some people respond to it, I suppose, depending on what they're going for. But many people eventually give up. You started off as a traditional psychotherapist, went into corporate consulting, and then went into a whole other level of helping people change their brains.
You know, I can thank the Medical and Dental Council for that because, you know, I have to get CPD points, continuing professional development. And into my inbox came, I think the first work that I encountered was TRE, which is the stress and trauma release process, tremor process. So all mammals, when they're in shock, they tremor. And, you know, you can, if you don't know if you've seen the YouTube pictures, they dart the polar bear and then the polar bear recovers from the anesthetic and shakes and then does the gasp. So it's released the trauma. And then I discovered the BWRT, brain working recursive therapy. And it was, you know, the results from that are just spectacular. So I could fix a, help someone heal a sexual abuse in 20 minutes, which previously in talk therapy would take 6 months, once a week, talking, analyzing the psychodynamics.
But probably not changing really their response
and
to the world.
Not a significant impact. Mm. So with something like BWRT, I also now do the brain spotting and the EMI, the eye movement integration work, which works neurally. It works, so you've got the neocortex limbic system below it and then the brain stem and the body. So it's nonverbal, it's preverbal, it's not conscious. So it gets to, I mean, I've created a power protocol in the BWRT model that is absolutely incredible. I've done about 100 of them in the last year. And let me give you the background to it. So with trauma, you've got, when you're a kid, your parents, your teachers, someone bullies you at school. You want to go into fight or flight to protect yourself. It's a natural physiological response. If you can't fight or flee, you freeze. And when you freeze, that pain and that anger, what I call the fight back response, is frozen in the body. And it's stuck there. And then we dissociate. So we tell a story. Yeah, but you know what? You need to be peaceful and you need to be nice to people. And then you talk to someone else and you know what? He bastard, he isn't. People are lost in this dissociated story, which is an attempt to discharge the frozen pain and fight back response. But the dissociated story that everybody's telling each other and themselves is a failed attempt to discharge that energy. So in my power protocol, you know, we go to the worst moment of the trauma, we disappear it, and then they create a fight back response. So for instance, I worked with a woman yesterday. She's a wonderful, sensitive, caring person. Of course, sensitive, caring people need this work more than anyone. Because they're identified with being kind and loving and sensitive. What they're missing is power. Self-esteem is love for yourself and the power to protect yourself from a world that is very often dangerous. I often say, the world is predator and prey. So the little birds eat the little worms and the big birds eat the little birds and the big fish eat the little fish and the big animals eat the little animals and the people eat everything. And the big corporations eat the small corporations and the husband beats the wife. Sometimes the other way around. People steal your money. They take your time. They abuse you. So there are predators everywhere. Self-esteem means to love yourself and to have the power to fight back. So with this woman, when she was 12 years old, the sports teacher took her and some of her friends into a shed and started doing sex talk with them. So it was sexual abuse. And he would touch the back of their bra on their back and so on. So in the power protocol, we disappeared the pain and then she created a fight back response, which for her was she took a baseball bat and just started hitting him across the head and ripped his glasses off and then jumped on his chest and then ran out the room. That releases a fight back response that's been sitting in her body for 35 years. So she's quite motivated. She's good at doing homework. And when people can do this stuff on their own, it works really well. So I texted her to see how she was doing. And she says, well, today I feel like I have all the power in the world. I emailed you last night. Today I've never felt more ready for a confrontation. And it must be from our session. That's what the power protocol does. BWRT level one, which is what we're talking about, isn't supposed to work with identity issues, self-esteem. It's just working with shock trauma. Yes. What I've discovered is if I do enough of these power protocols where appropriate, it can start to shift the identity. So that's the power of the neural therapy.
So how do you know? We know that the brain doesn't really know the difference between a memory, what we're creating in our imagination, and what's going on in reality. So we start building new neural pathways that make this so. What is the physiological function of the neural therapy? What does it do in the actual physical brain to remap experience?
Well, this hasn't been measured. So my answer is I have no idea. But there are multiple ways in which my clients look different and report feeling different. When I created the Power Protocol, the way I created it was to work on myself. So I'll tell you how I got there. I'm saying fight, flight, freeze. There's a frozen fight back response stuck inside. So what I want to do is release that. The cells of our liver are not interested in ethics, morality, and compassion. They just want to survive. That's all they want to do. So if you're identified with being kind and sensitive and caring, you're not interested in survival because you're overridden by this belief system that freezes your fight back response and it's stuck in your body. So developmental trauma is where our self-esteem has been raped. And Carolyn Mace says everyone has had their self-esteem raped. So everyone, 100% of people have developmental trauma disorder. So I went through my list, which I created years ago, like 50 issues of developmental trauma disorder in myself. So I took those instances and I did 33 power protocols on myself in 3 weeks. And I felt an extraordinary difference. And you know what the difference was? I mean, I've done thousands of hours of work on myself, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. But there was a loosening up of my more authentic, spontaneous, original self-esteem self. And to give an example of that, you know, I wear hearing aids. Mm. So in the past, the battery dies on the hearing aid and I'd sort of sit there and think and wait for a gap and maybe not even do it after the session. Now I would sort of take it out in the middle of the session and just say, hang on, I'm going to change the battery in my hearing aid. That's after years of the other psychological work. That's the power of the Power Protocol. And then I watch my clients. You know, this text message I read you this morning, that's the kind of thing that I get from people. It doesn't work with everybody all the time. Nothing works all the time. And BWRT has been sort of given a bit of a bad rap, partly maybe created by, you know, Terence Watts and the way it's been set up, that it's seen as a bit too good to be true. Just the way people have talked about it, and it's not too good. I've probably done 500 BWRT protocols in the last 3 years, and it is astounding. So in the brain spotting, you know, is the eyes. I don't know if I should explain the technique.
Yes, let's go into exactly how that works and where it came from.
Okay. So if I say to you, describe your office to me.
Okay.
Can you do that? Describe yes. What did your eyes do?
They went up to the top
they
right
went,
hand
They moved.
Side. Yes.
I ask every client that question. Every client moves their eyes, not necessarily up, sometimes down.
Sure.
We move our eyes to access memory. REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. There's 4 stages of sleep, and the deepest is REM, where we have the deepest dreams. The eyes move to access memory, to create dreams, to process and integrate. So what it's saying is that when somebody starts to tell you about a trauma, they will look, say, to the right and down, and then they will start to tell you. And honestly, it can be as powerful as BWRT.
So you're remapping the memory of where it's located in the brain, almost neutralizing it.
You're allowing where it's hooked into the brain, which goes into the limbic system from the eyes and then down into the brainstem into the body. You're allowing the body to release all of that trauma that's held unconsciously. So it's not telling a story. Yeah, well, you know, when my father died, it was so painful. It was, which is a neocortex dissociated story about the pain.
Yeah.
Here is a person might say, yeah, I can just remember my father when he died and how sad it was. And then I'll say, and what does that feel like in your body? And can you just make a space to feel it in your body without trying to understand it or fix it? Or judge it, yeah, absolutely. Mm. And what happens is it will release. And that's what happens with somatic work. So you're combining somatic work with this eye connection. In somatic work, you know, when we feel sadness or anxiety, say the sadness is in the chest, then we want to get rid of it. And it's the opposite in somatic work. You just open to the sadness and it will release itself.
When they say to sit with the pain, to sit with the feeling, which most of us are averse to because we try and fix it.
Yes.
We try and deal with it. Yes. But to simply sit with it can transform.
Well, you're sitting with it, doing something slightly different from just sitting with it. You're sitting with it and being with it and being open to it. So there's a kind of an intimate, gentle, compassionate allowing, which has a slightly different flavor from
it
sit
is.
With it. And I often use, because people say to me, well, how does this work? And I have an analogy. I say, if you cut your finger, you might put a plaster on it, right? You don't walk around all day saying bacteria die. And then I say to clients, why not? And you know they can't answer the question. The question is, you trust your immune system to kill the bacteria, create a scab, and form new skin. So now when we just bring awareness, so now the neocortex is useful because that is that awareness. You bring that awareness to the sadness in your chest. It allows the body to release the pain of the sadness. It might make it worse initially. It might move into anger, into different part of the body, then a tightness, and it releases itself.
In my practice, I see a hell of a lot of autoimmune disease. And people who just take a pill for the odd ache and pain, not realizing that something's trapped there. And when we start doing this somatic work, so my background is in PNI, which is got some relation to BWRT, but it's a bit of a different discipline. What in your experience, do you see many patients with autoimmune? And when they start doing the work, what changes from the physical disease spectrum?
Sometimes people get a little better, sometimes not. I can't say that I've tracked it in order to be able to say there are very specific patterns around this, but some people do get better because there's a link to the psychology and the trauma that creates the autoimmune disease. Sometimes there's an improvement and sometimes not.
You know, with anything, there's no one answer or one fix, and not everybody's going to respond. And I think autoimmune is something that is a long time coming for many people. It probably started 10 years before they start getting physical symptoms. So what I'm picking up here is that self-awareness that you can do the mental work, you can do the somatic work, but if you're not going to listen to your body and understand what it needs nutritionally, sleep-wise, if you're in a toxic environment, it's not going to work. You can't go to a doctor and get a pill and hope it goes away. And you can't come to a therapist and just do some therapy and hope it goes away. This is a whole big picture, and it takes a remapping of self-respect, of am I going to do what I need to fix myself? And that takes changing your life very often. And it often takes changing your social circle too, because sometimes the people in our lives are toxic and it's reflecting in the body. Mm-hmm. Do you see a lot of that, especially in a work environment, for example, where there's a lot of bullying and competition going on?
Well, firstly, let me just address the first bit. You know, I'm glad you raised the nutrition exercise thing. I now ask in my history form what you eat and what exercise you do. And I never used to do that. But it's critical what you eat. And people eat the carbs and the sugars and the inflammatory foods, which are going to make it all a lot worse. So that is critical. What's interesting, and I'm sure you find the same thing, is people don't have a motivation to focus on that. I mean, I had a client who, he was a very successful sportsman and developed a gut bacteria problem. All indigestion and all sorts of things. And I got him to do heart rate variability breathing before he ate, while he ate, and afterwards. And it reduced his indigestion by like 90%.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a very disciplined kind of guy.
Sports people are the best people to work with. I absolutely love them. Yeah. They do exactly what you tell them to do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because they know how to focus.
And they're used to being coached. So they just do what the coach says.
Yes.
And it works.
Yeah.
So let's chat about heart rate variability. It is something that's becoming more popular. It's not about your heartbeat and how low you can get your heartbeat. Can you explain heart rate variability?
So when we breathe in, the heart rate speeds up. When we breathe out, it slows down. The bigger the variation, the less stressed, healthier, and fit you are.
What is variation?
Meaning the variation between its peak when you breathe in and its slowing down when you breathe out. So the bigger the gap between it speeding up and slowing down on the breathing. So you want to increase the gap. And of course, what's wonderful about it is you breathe in 5 seconds and you breathe out 5 seconds. I use the Elite HRV app.
It's a free app on most phones, yes.
You know, you need a chest strap heart rate variability monitor. You know what's really interesting about it? Everybody has these Fitbits and stuff. And it doesn't work with that. Mm. And I emailed them in America and they said, there are too many ligaments and tendons in the wrist. And I found the wrist ones are not accurate. I bought one for Sue, my partner. I even wore it because she said, I don't think this is accurate. So I'd get to the top of the hill. My heartbeat, I know, is 150 and it's showing 120. And then 3 minutes later, it shows 100. Mm. I measure it every single morning. It is, there's even research that shows improving heart rate variability reduces inflammation.
So meditation doesn't work for everybody. And you've developed a different way of doing it.
I use Ajahn Chah's meditation technique. which, you know, all the meditation techniques, you watch your breath, you have a mantra, you watch your thoughts, or you have images or pictures, which means you can only do it with your eyes closed. And it made no difference to my life. Whereas Ajahn Shanti's meditation technique is just sitting, doing nothing. So right now, I'm noticing what is here beneath the talking and within the talking and the listening and the connection with you. And so I can just feel that meditative energy while I'm speaking, typing, cooking, walking. And yeah, for me, and I teach it to a lot of clients. It's an amazing technique because you can bring it into your life. And if meditation is connection with who you really are, then it's always here. So you don't have to close your eyes and focus on a flower or a mantra or your breath.
That sounds very much like what they call flow state, being in the now. Without trying too hard.
Well, it's really interesting you say that because I think a flow state is a meditative state. And that's what you're saying. And, you know, I say a lot of my clients who work in business who have anxiety about presentations and so on, I say to them, I must have asked 500 people this question in the last 10 years. I'll say, have you ever given a presentation? You started off anxious, dry mouth and checking the room and checking yourself. So you split here. Look, watching yourself, and you're looking at yourself through the critical people's eyes in the room. So you split into all these pieces. And then suddenly you click into what's called the zone or the flow state. And they say, yes. I'll say, so what happened there was spontaneously, without your having any control over it, you stopped being self-conscious. And you just allowed your spirit to move your brain and your mouth. And so in a sense for me, when that happens to you, you're having a spiritual experience. And I don't care if you're atheist or agnostic. That's what's happening. So what people do is they're meditating and they're praying and they're doing all this spiritual religious stuff in order to try and uplift themselves and connect with God or universal consciousness or their higher self or whatever. But all of this emotional garbage is sitting repressed underneath it. So they're bypassing it. They're bypassing all of their emotional pain. I have a great concern with a lot of these workshops. You know, a lot of these people are just doing a bypass. So when you get into all your emotional pain, they'll say, I'm not interested in the drama. Now, that emotional pain is because your father died, you got raped. That's trauma sitting in the body and the brainstem. They're trying to meditate and rise above it, and all they're doing is bypassing and repressing it, which is like putting perfume on manure. You don't get rid of the smell.
It's still there.
And these people are faking it.
Right.
And John Wellwood created in the 80s, a Buddhist psychologist. Yeah. I only discovered this a couple of years ago, and I wished I'd discovered it before, because I did a lot of bypassing. I was trying to suppress my humanness because I was transcending it. And they'll say, well, you've transcended it. It's just a thought, and who's doing the thinking anyway, and all of this. So for me, the work is you work on the pain, work on the trauma, release that, preferably neurally, with some talking. You need to do some talking. And then it's not a bypass. So you're connecting heaven with earth. You're connecting your human mammal. We have a mammal body. So a lot of the spiritual work is a bypassing of the animal body and an attempt to escape the inevitable pain and vulnerability.
And that is so ironic because so many of these spiritual practices say that being human is spirit having a human experience.
Yes.
But we're bypassing it. So,
well, they're trying to avoid the humanness of that experience.
So where's that embracing humanity? And isn't this one of the reasons we're becoming disconnected from ourselves and everybody else?
Well, I want to read you something else that I've been reading this to my clients for the last 9 months that I got from my somatic experiencing therapist. And it is David White. So he writes about vulnerability. So spiritual bypassing is an attempt to escape our vulnerability, our humanness, our needs for survival, our fear of not having money, our fear of sickness, our sense of loss when people around us die or are ill, our fear of being criticized, rejected, abandoned, isolated, all the shame and the guilt that gets programmed into us. This is our vulnerability. So David White says, vulnerability is not a weakness, a passing indisposition, or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, and abiding undercurrent of our natural state. So what are the spiritual guys saying? The spiritual guys are saying, no, this isn't really happening to you. your spirit is untouched by this. Now, that may be true. Maybe your spirit is untouched by this. But your humanness, your body, your gut is radiating this pain, trauma, hurt. When your partner leaves you, when you leave your partner, this is difficult. You know Ram Dass? And I'll never forget him saying, this was 25 years ago, and I was so impressed with it. And I didn't know the concept of bypassing, but he was showing how you don't want to bypass. He said his partner, I don't know if his partner left him or was having an affair, and he said he got into the bath and he found himself overwhelmed with a jealous rage. And I just love that because it's real. Just because you have this awakened connection
doesn't mean you're any less human.
You don't feel abandoned.
Of course. Yeah. And how do we hope to have real relationships with somebody else if we can't be vulnerable with them?
Well, I love what you just said, because you said, how do we have real relationships? These people are fake. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And you know, I'm on a lot of Facebook spiritual groups, and I watch these arguments and these fights. A lot of these, I don't know if you've seen them, these fake spiritual, somebody says, I've got a lot of trauma and I'm meditating a lot, and can I get past my trauma with meditation? And somebody says, who's the one thinking that they're having trauma? So it's just bullshit. And they don't understand that they're just bypassing their own trauma and recommending somebody else do that. And you know, I like Ajahn Shanti, and he will say, go and see a good trauma therapist. You cannot meditate that away. You've got to, and for me, it's neural therapies, the EMI, brain spotting, BWRT are the best ways. Somatic experiencing are the best ways to do that.
Let's talk about guilt. I know on your blog, you've got a lovely article about, a lovely blog entry about guilt. So many people are weighed down by their own guilt that they create in their lives because of whatever reason. Let's go into guilt as a topic.
Okay, so I'm delighted you raised this because I love the concept of guilt and shame. So, you know, because I love it so much, I've created a beautiful dialogue that I can have for the client. It takes about half an hour. So let's say they have guilt about abusing their partner in some way emotionally, being an angry person. And I go through my whole thing, starting with the little boy walks and falls down. And then where does guilt come from? It's projected into you. A two-year-old doesn't feel guilty until the parent says, naughty boy. And I talk about all the ways in which our society programs and encourages guilt. Before I've done that, I've got them to score out of 10 their level of guilt. And let's say it's a 10 out of 10. So distress score is maximum guilt. I then do my guilt dialogue with them. And I say, what's your score now? And mostly it doesn't get below 8 out of 10. Usually it's 9 out of 10 and often stays at 10 out of 10. So what's that saying? It's saying that a neocortex discussion about guilt is useless. Because the guilt is sitting in the brainstem and in the body. And you can't talk to your brainstem. It's called a reptilian brain because it's a reptile. You can't, I say to my clients, what happens if the crocodile's about to eat the little buck at the side of the dam?
You can't reason with the crocodile. You
say, please, shame, it's a little buck, shame, shame. It has no language. So our brainstem has no language. And that's the drawback of talk therapy. You can't talk easily to the guilt and transform it. So then what I'll do is I'll do a brain spotting or a BWRT on the guilt, anywhere between 20 minutes and 50 minutes, an hour, and the guilt score goes down to 1 or 2 or naught. And it's just fascinated me. So I'll say, you know, I'm a genius at guilt dialogues and it's useless. It
doesn't do anything.
Because it's a neocortex dialogue. And that's where all of our pain sits. It sits in the brainstem, in the amygdala and limbic system and in the body.
Neil Donald Walsh, in one of his Conversations with God books, says, and I'll never forget this, how pointless the emotion of guilt is. It doesn't serve anybody. It is completely a construct of humanity. Yeah. And that was profound because, I mean, Conversations with God is the antithesis of religion, obviously.
Yeah.
And religion is all around being guilty, about repentance and, you know, asking for forgiveness. And what is the hope for humanity if we're living in this state of I'm bad, I'm never good enough? Is there any hope?
Look, I say it's a crime against humanity to make people feel not okay. Kids, not okay because their marks are bad, they're having angry outbursts, they can't focus and concentrate. So as long as we do that, then we're programming children to feel guilt.
So what advice could you give parents who go, I don't want to instill this in my children? What is the first step?
The first step is heal your own guilt, because they will watch you feel guilty. Oh, I didn't phone my mother. Oh, I feel so bad. And she's in hospital and I don't want to go and visit her. And I wish I should go and visit her, but it's so terrible. And I feel so. So now you're just teaching your kid the scenario of guilt.
Yeah.
Once you worked on it yourself, your kid is going to pick up guilt, if not from you, somewhere else, because we live ridden with it in our culture. Then you say to the kid comes home and says, oh, mommy, look how badly I did. So with little kids work beautifully somatically. I'll do with the kid what I want the mother to do. The body will release it. And then you say to them, then you'll work with the beliefs. You see, then you go to the neocortex. But we do the neocortex first.
Oh.
Then instead of saying, you know, you don't need to feel bad, because that's what the parental lecture is just the hell nightmare of all time. Just give them a lecture. You don't need to feel bad. It's absolutely fine if you aren't the best. Everybody closes down conversations. I mean, I have a friend, Natalie. She's really brilliant. She says, nobody listens to anybody. It's just a projection. So their friend will say, you know what? I think I'm going to quit my job. No, don't do it without having another job. They haven't asked a single question about what's happening in the job. What are your chances of getting another one? How much money do you have saved? No questions. Just a projection.
Stuff.
You've got to work on yourself. Guilt is useless, but it's programmed into you. Unless you work with where it's stuck in you, in your body, in your brainstem. You know, I say to my clients, how many self-help books have you read?
Nothing's worked.
None of it's worked, because it's a psychological and spiritual bypass. It's an attempt to cover all of this up with positive, I can do it, I can make it happen, don't sweat the small stuff. Why? There's a belief system that's in the brain, in the neocortex, and it's right in the body that I have to love. I mustn't, which means I must give, but I mustn't balance it with power, which is taking.
Why do so many people battle to ask for help? I'm one of those. But I'm very happy to give help to anybody who needs it.
Okay.
What is that about?
Okay, so I can talk from personal experience too, because that's always been my tendency. So we're born sensitive. We grow up in an environment that's relatively or very toxic. Our parents fight. They criticize. They judge. They lecture. They discount us. So what do we learn to do? We learn to give and to be supportive and caring, to be nice, and it kind of works. So if it works, and that's all we know, that's what we do. But if we're giving, where's the fight back response, which says, don't talk to me like that. I went to see my doctor this morning and I popped in to buy some supplements, and he saw me and I made a joke, and he says, oh, you're nuts. I said, that's not nice. And he said, now, in the past, I would never have said to him, that's not nice. I challenged him, and he's a doctor. So when you're brought up with this vulnerability and stuff, you're not taught to fight back. And my clients, I sometimes say to them, I want to do a power protocol with you. I want your fight back response. No, I'm not an aggressive person. Now we've got to have a long discussion. Why does he not like aggression? Why does he not like his anger? Why does he not like his fight back response? Because he thinks the world must be filled with peace. Honestly, yes, all the peace movements in the world are wonderful. Beautiful, beautiful. But you know what? I agree with Demartini. You cannot get rid of war. In order to have a concept of peace, it's only there because of war. And people will fight war and have peace. Somebody will take advantage of you. If you just do giving and love, they will destroy you. And you will destroy yourself and maybe create an immune disease or chronic fatigue like I have. By blocking your fight back response.
The need to be liked.
Yes. So, going back to your question of help, asking for help is vulnerable. We are taking care of others in order to feel safe. And it's a bit of a bypass, because it feels like I'm so loving and I'm so good. You know, I'm so good, and why is the world such an awful place? Power protocol work is to be more aggressive, and then can you be vulnerable and, where appropriate, ask for help?
Can you be both?
So if we can't ask for help, we are running from our vulnerability, which is the David White thing. It's not a choice, vulnerability. It's the underlying essence of being a human being. We're going to die. We get sick. It's scary. You can't get away from it. You know, I love the story of the monk, the story of a monk who's dying and he's old and all of his disciples around him for his last words to hear this beautiful wisdom. And his last words are, I don't want to die. I love it, because it's not a bypass. It's not a transcendent. I am merging with oneness into pure bliss.
There's
bless
no
you all.
BS. There. It's just.
It's real. And that's for me the point. You know, can you bring your spiritual practice into blended with your reality?
So just to wrap up, you've written a book. Which
yes.
is available on Amazon.
Yes.
Where can people listening get hold of you? And do you consult, you know, not just in Johannesburg, but do you consult via Skype? If people want to interact with you and learn more, how can they get hold of you?
The best way is to email me, realmark@icon.co.za. And I do Skype sessions.
Okay.
Yeah, I've even done BWRT on Skype, and it really works.
Yes. You have a whole lot of tools. You've got a course. So there's many ways that people can try something different if their normal therapies aren't working. And thank you so much for today. It's been incredible. And it's always such a spiritual experience chatting about these things, because unless we think differently, nothing's going to change. And I wish more people could embrace just embracing their humanity, and the world will be a better place.
Thank you. And great talking to you.
Thank you.
This episode has been sponsored by Jackson's Whole Food Market. If you would like to win a hamper full of delicious, healthy products, please go to the link in the show notes, which can be found at reinventhealth.co.za/podcast notes. Include your name and loyalty card number and stand a chance to win.